will be the most effective long term. Follow Palestinian journalists on Instagram, on Twitter. Follow media that accurately shows what's going on. Hold media accountable when you see headlines that are speaking like using the passive voice when it comes to what is going on when people are being murdered. Start making phone calls, start emailing those journalists, those media offices, and tell them, you know, you have a right, to have, you know, journalistic integrity and in how you're speaking about genocide. Apart from that, you know, amplifying Palestinian voices, supporting Palestinian artists, wherever they may be. It might seem mundane, but you don't realize just how many people that are in the industry are using those means to also help Palestinians. So just know that when you're supporting Palestinian business, when you're supporting Palestinian artwork, that you're also supporting people on the ground, and to also seek mutual aid funds that you know are going directly to Palestine. A lot of the aid that ends up being passed through still goes through inflation, so it becomes, even if the aid is accessible, it still is inaccessible to the everyday person that isn't making an income if their workplaces have been bombed. So to realize that mutual aid is really what is helping Palestinians get medicine, to get food, to get shelter. So you can visit the QC4P Vancouver Instagram page. We have a list of mutual aid things. People can go there and donate. Long-term donations help a lot. So if you're boycotting, it already helps because you're not spending that money somewhere else. So use that money that you're boycotting from, cut those costs and make those sacrifices and donate that money. And keep educating yourself. Never feel like there's something you can't learn that's new. And then bearing witness is like the bare minimum. But if you have kids or if it's too hard and these things come up, you know, at least know you can still read the stories and amplify them, and you know, remember it's a marathon. It's not a race.
Thank you. Could you name some of those news organizations that you were talking about?
I can speak about CBC has a known history of even censoring the word Palestine. I don't know if it's still the case now, but they have a long history of censorship, and who can I name? Like BBC, many, the New York Times, how many times you've seen the headline, but you see people of good conscience take that headline and edit their own what they actually mean to say in red ink. You don't have to go far to it, and maybe it might just take a little bit of education around what is the passive voice, or you know, just a little bit more critical thinking when you see headlines. What is using the certain type of language? What kind of frame are they really building, or are they really being objective to name the atrocities that are going on, and who is committing the atrocities?
Yeah, definitely really important to think whenever you're looking at any media to examine what they're actually saying. Yeah. And QUAIA, do you have any do you have anything you want the people to take away from this? Is there anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Elle covered a lot very well and comprehensively. So only to add that I think that one of the things that we're doing at QUAIA specifically is that, you know, we want to build on the momentum of the Queer Film Festival and that victory, which involved many people in the sense of like so many people who supported, particularly both before October 7th and after, who signed our letter, who's, you know, sent out information, who pressured organizations, etc. But I think to build that momentum, one of the things that we want to see, and we're putting the word out, is that we want to see a flood, particularly, like, you know, all sorts of organizations, but particularly queer organizations and collectives and groups and spaces sign on to PACB. And if there is economic divestment needed, but that's not usually the case with many of them. PACB is really more specifically where we want to see a commitment from. So that's, again, the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott, which, of course, the cultural boycott, which is what would apply in most of these cases. So we want to see a tangible commitment from various organizations, particularly queer ones. So if you're part of a queer organization or even a collective or a movement space, maybe you're a drag artist or you know somebody, there's many people who can commit to PACB. It doesn't even just have to be an organization and can make a tangible, solid commitment to Palestine. So we're putting the word out. Get in touch. You can follow us at, it's a long Instagram handle, but at Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. On Instagram, and that's also Queers Against Israeli Apartheid at gmail.com. And we have already folks who are in touch with us, for example, who want to see this happen, who are queer folks who want to see this in their various organizations, who are maybe artists or like staff, etc. So we're going to be doing work with them. And so we're also offering like training and education for folks, as we did with the Queer Film Festival, which we worked on with education on the BDS movement and also the connection to like pink washing and why it's important for us to speak up. So we want to really just see this grow and grow, because right now, as far as we know, in terms of this being a historic moment, is that even in terms of beyond queer film festivals, as far as we know, this is the only film festival that we know of in so-called BC, particularly more kind of larger mainstream festival that has signed on to PACB. So we want to change that.
Thank you. And also, are there any actions that are coming up that people can join for either QC4P or QUAIA?
I think one thing we're, have worked on together is, you may be aware that because they're public, is that we did put out demands. We did try to meet with the Vancouver Pride Society. We hoped that it would, like, we had some hope in the meeting because we were led to believe that there may be some possible shifts coming. Right. Even though we know their history has not been great, especially with Black Lives Matter and others. And so it didn't go great. And as a result, we put our demands that we had put to them, which they rejected publicly. So I think, there's probably just for now to amplify the demands. And I think we also did put out basically that people can get in touch with them and pressure them on that front. For now, that's, I think, an important thing to do. So that connects back to really like holding, you know, the organizations or the groups and stuff, particularly organizations that you may be involved with that are claiming to be for 2S LGBTQ rights, etc., queer and trans rights, like hold them accountable. So that's, I think, a very specific thing that people can do. And I think there will be probably more actual actions from both groups as well. So I'll hand it over to Elle.
Thank you. Yes, I would also say to support the demands that were posted to Vancouver Pride Society, amplify those. And for now, our group is kind of still bearing our grounds, growing as a group. So we also have, we will have more events in the future, but for now you can follow us at QC4P Vancouver on Instagram. We are also still recovering from all of the planning that took place ahead of so-called Vancouver Pride weekend. So,
thank you. Yeah, holding the hypocrite accountable would be very effective. And I'll link some of the things they're saying in the CGSF page on Pride programming if you guys didn't catch that. Do you look at any anti-colonial struggles for liberation in other countries for inspiration? QC4P, would you like to answer the question first?
Sure. There's definitely inspiration to be drawn from colonial struggles all over the world. I look at Congolese workers who went on strike during the ongoing genocide. I look at history, historically speaking, the Haitian Revolution. So I'm not a history buff. So I feel like my inspiration comes when I see the same people fighting for other anti-colonial struggles also raising the Palestinian flag and being in solidarity, and just seeing a united front.
Yeah, it's such a good question. I think it is really important that you know, we understand, but not just understand, but actually embody into our organizing and actual actions this idea that our struggles are connected. It's not enough to just say that. So I think that's really important. You know, there's some I think important conversations, probably don't have time to get into that today, that are happening right now that remind me, like around Kamala Harris and you know, the pressure that people is being put on people, including Palestinians, around like engaging in the election period and then critiques for not doing so. And I think that it's important to kind of make those links. And we are seeing some really important Black voices speaking out in terms of like the importance of being in consistent struggle with Palestine. And that struggle has been, those two struggles, I think, for Black liberation and Palestinian liberation have been historically linked for so long, right? James Baldwin, there's so many, like historically, June Jordan, currently, like, right, Dream Defenders, people who have gone to Palestine and have actually been working with Palestinians there and in the diaspora, and that continue to. So I think that's important. And I think the other piece of it is for us is that as Kwaya, we also, most of our folks have been involved one way or the other in anti-war and anti-imperialist movements, and work in the city for many years, one way or the other. And so that's including like working directly and being impacted for some of us by the war on terror, for example, but also like expanding what our definition of that means. And so I think we're definitely very much, and we make it very clear that we are in try to be in active solidarity as much as we can with all Indigenous people fighting for self-determination and settler colonialism, whether it's here, you know, on these territories that are unceded, whether it's with Kashmir, against their fight against Indian occupation and settler colonialism, right? So we also see the kind of like direct links between longtime links that have been built, again, historically and currently between the Kashmiri liberation movement and the liberation for Palestine, and a lot of similarities there that people don't talk about. So that's important. And I think beyond that also, like, for us is to expand, like, of course, as Elle talked about, like the inspiration from like Haitian revolution and Haitian struggles, independence, places like Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and also looking for us, I think, beyond that into understanding that the fight against settler colonialism and authoritarianism in places like Tibet, for Uyghur and other ethnic minority communities in China. So for us, it's really important that we be consistent when we say we fight for the self-determination and in solidarity with all Indigenous people across the globe, and that we're not selective in that process. For us, that's really, really critical, because our understanding and analysis of anti-imperialism is that it's much broader and wider than just fighting U.S. imperialism, which has been a central tenet, of course, of our organizing, but also we fight other forms of imperialism and authoritarianism around the world, which we stand highly against and very strongly. And that is also something that has brought us some criticism, but we're unequivocal in the fact that we are in solidarity with people, not with states.
And thank you so much to Logan Hathaway for that interview. Two-part interview. You can catch the rest of it, or sorry, not the rest of it, but the part one on our website, which will be posted there. And this interview will also be posted on the website later this afternoon. That was Logan Hathaway's two-part interview on queer resistance to Israeli oppression in Palestine.
And now we're going to move on to the second part of our Speak Up Now segment.
Yeah.
I'm looking to talk with Joel now, understanding a little bit why mobilizing students and young voters is so important, a little bit of the issues that are surrounding this election, and yeah, basically how you're facing it. So if I may start, I would love to ask you, Joel, to introduce a little bit of yourself, what you're representing here, and what's your engagement with these elections?
Good morning. I am Joel Gilani. I am the VP External for the Simon Fraser Student Society. Really going into the election campaigning process for the provincial elections, we've been doing a lot of work trying to get students mobilized. But before we start, I want to acknowledge that we are on the traditional unceded territories of the Coast Salish people of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh Nations. And as we're working towards reconciliation, this is a form of an action that we're taking, actively trying to make sure that we're engaging with our students, we're engaging with our communities in a good way. And that's what guides all of our actions.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, that's really important. We are excited here in Burnaby East, which we're speaking about a larger community that's going to be represented after all. So, moving on to the importance of this election for students, I'm just trying to catch here a little bit of your opinion on the past election. So we do see lots of frustration with everything that hasn't been addressed, a lot of promise, as it happens anywhere when you're discussing about politics. And we do see some underrepresentation in student issues, at least I think so, seeing that millennials are now the largest voting group, one in five voters for this in BC. So what do you see? What can you say about the past elections? Do you think that any expectations are met? Any critical errors remain overlooked?
Those are huge topics to unpack. I'll touch on a few points that you've mentioned. Firstly, the differences between past elections and this election would be just how big of a cost of living crisis we are in currently. Past elections, people had the chance to get officials elected that really would have wanted to make sure that we address these issues. So housing has been a huge issue. Our healthcare crisis has been a big issue. Provincial funding for post-secondary education has been a big issue. And none of the candidates would ever say, no, we don't want to do anything about it. But I don't think they've done enough. And now that things have come to a forefront, everybody's trying to make sure that they have something to say about these topics. And I think that is a good place for students to come in and say, yes, students, I say this often to provincial officials if I meet them, is universities are sort of a mini universe in itself. So whatever issues are going to show up in the broader public are going to show up at universities first. If university students are complaining about something, this is going to be a much bigger issue for you. So you have to address these issues at the root, because these are the students going into the broader economy, going into the public. And we're facing the same issues as the general public is. So you have to recognize that what you do here is very important. So the last point you were saying was about engaging students and like...
Yeah, I've asked about general expectations, if from the previous elections the expectations were met, and what we're facing now, how the politicians are addressing some of these concerns, if they have included this in their platform.
Oh, definitely the expectations haven't been met. And you can see that in how people are rushing to make sure that there's university housing happening. They just upped their targets from 8,000 beds constructed during their term to 12,000, just to say that, hey, we're doing this new construction. But there's still a lack of funding for university housing. We've seen year over year that provincial education funding has reduced. And now with the international student caps, there's going to be a much bigger gap. How are universities supposed to be funded? Are we privatizing our public education? Is that what's happening? So there's definitely a huge gap, and there's lots of work to be done. And it seems like a helter-skelter effort by every single person to make sure that that's happening.
Yeah, if I've seen it correctly, I believe like around 2% of the inflation hasn't been met in when we're talking about like increasing it enough of public funds to help the universities. And as you said, with the gap in international students, less enrollments because of some federal policies, we see that it's turning out that the academy is getting through a hard time. And yeah, thank you for all these points you have raised. I would like to, do you have any specific issues that you would like to abort here today? I think that you've touched on a few, you've touched on housing, but is there any particular issue that stands out as most emotion resonant for students?
I think everything's underpinned with the cost of living crisis. So the rising cost of tuition, I feel sympathetic for SFU officials. Like, they've had to cut so much of their services, and they're trying to work with our students to figure out what's the best way for them to use their funding, but it's too little too late. And it's only happened because of how we've ignored such a big problem for so long. So there's definitely policies we can put into place to make sure that we're all being involved more. And that cost of living crisis gives rise to lack of access to healthcare. We have a health and counseling service on campus, but it's very, very limited. We need more support from Fraser Health. We need more support from provincial government to be able to pay for these sorts of services so that our students have access to a reliable source of healthcare. I will graduate soon, and I think I will have to start looking for a family doctor a year in advance, and I still doubt that I'll be able to find one. And these are challenges that everybody's facing. I would say another big one is the housing crisis. There's not enough student housing on campus, but recognizing that most of our students are commuters. They commute from different parts of the cities. They come from Surrey, they come from Langley, they all travel. And a lot of these students rent, right? So how are we pinning in affordable transit, so working with UPass, and how are we making sure that the housing options that students have available in the wider economy are affordable? So we're working with UVic and UBC student groups to promote vacancy control, which is tying the cost of rental increases to your house instead of to the renter itself. These are services that have been these are sort of policies that have been very, very successful in cities like Montreal. So why can't we implement those sorts of things? So it seems like we can have these are issues that we can have answers for if we choose to work together. But there's been so much inaction that we just haven't seen that. And that's what I'm working on this year.
Yeah, I've walked around campus. If you ask any students, they are all going to say the same. They are all going to point out the same issues. And I found it really interesting that you brought up this policy of Montreal. I've never heard of it. So, yeah, I think it's something that we can work more on. And talking about these policies and your voice being amplified, students' voice being amplified, how do you think the politicians can be more directly in touch with the student population? I mean, what's the reason for this gap where during the election time they hear somewhat about those issues, but there is no actual conversation? There is any gap that you see? How can we work on this for a better communication between politicians and the student groups?
I would say students have gotten disillusioned with our provincial officials. It is saddening how politicians everywhere get a bad rap. I was elected to my position, and I feel saddened that I haven't had the chance to spend more time with my student body. I want to be able to do that, and that's one of the challenges. Engagement is one of the challenges I think everybody faces. But there's a reason for that disillusionment, I would think, and it comes from the fact that a lot of these politicians do come out during the election period, and then we never hear from them again. But the street goes both ways. I have reached out as just a constituent to the provincial office, the MLA office, just call them up, and they're ready to help out. So I think it's a two-way gap. I don't think students understand how much of a voice they have, and politicians always love hearing from us, no matter which side of the aisle they're on. Even if they don't agree with our views, they always want to listen to student voices. And I think that piece is missed. So what students need to do is go out and express their opinions, use social media, use channels, use ways to organize within your communities to be able to say, yes, my voice matters. And you have to really believe that your voice matters for it to matter.
Thank you for touching on that. I really wanted to hop in this. How can the youth engage more with the politicians? So you already brought up a few examples that I love. I've recently heard about that something that happens in Vancouver, for instance, that is the youth council, where they engage directly with officials. And that's just something I would love to see more. Like, we're saying this about being both sideways, so like going both ways for politicians to engage more, but also to students to engage more. And if I can give a message today, it's like, let's find some new ways for students to engage. I don't see we having much time to dive into everything I wanted to hear today. So I would just like to understand, do you see any specific, more specific contributions that students can make for this election? So
students make up such a big group of active voters that if 50% more of them showed up to the polling stations, they would decide the votes. Like, there's such a big group of, like, students are supposed to be they have such a huge say in what happens, but they don't recognize the power the group as a whole holds. So I would say on the voting day, definitely show up, talk to your candidates, figure out what their stances are, where they stand. There's different groups out there who've like put resources out. SFSS has a resource where you can go plan to vote. You can figure out how to which candidates are running, where you're going to be voting. Those are good ways. But at the same time, you would really want to show up to vote. That's the first step. And after that, hold them accountable. I think that's it.
Yeah, holding them accountable, that's something hard to do. Trying to bring up the second way and actually hearing back with transparency of everything that's happening, all the discussions that have. So do you have any final message you would like to touch on, like any specific places to vote or any importance of the engagement itself? We have a few minutes left, so any final message?
Advanced polling is happening on SFU Burnaby campus on the 15th and 16th at the Halpern Center. Final day voting is happening at University Hall and Elementary School. But also we have other campuses, so giving them some love. Final day voting at SFU Surrey Engineering Building, VCC Downtown Campus, UBC Robson Square. VCC Downtown Campus and UBC Robson Square also have advanced polling. Go to Elections BC page to find out where to vote, when to vote. And register soon, because I think voting registration ends in a couple of days.
Okay. October 7th, if I can be more specific to contribute. Thank you so much for your participation. It was lovely hearing you. We have a second part yet to discuss a little bit more about this direct engagement with a campaign that's happening around a Generation Vote Now from the BCFS next Thursday. And thank you so much for being here.
Okay.
Thank you guys both for being here. And I do want to sort of amplify one of your last points, Joel, that when students raise their voice, politicians do pay attention. And I think, you know, for any group that wants to get the attention of the leadership, voting and speaking up is how you do it. I think students often have a pretty low participation rate. And when that happens, you know, students or politicians put their attention elsewhere. And when students get active, they open their eyes and they look. They don't want to ignore someone who's active. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. You're going to be back again next Thursday to talk about more issues, which is great, because I think student issues need to be raised up high, especially in these times of a cost of living crisis, when you know, everybody who's working full-time is having a hard time. Imagine what it's like for students who are maybe working part-time and have a full-time school load, and now you have to figure out how to make that work and not end up in so much debt at the end of it. It's kind of scary. All right, thanks so much, Joel Biggio and Hayago, And we had Logan Hathaway on earlier with the queer resistance in Palestine. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right now.